The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
دفاع الاحتلال الإسرائيلي إسرائيل كاتس إن الجيش سيواصل مهاجمة قواته.
Israel has carried out strikes on Syrian government forces in the southern city of Suweida. Israel says it aims to protect the local Druze minority after deadly clashes there.
قصف جديد قصف جديد يا شباب قصف جديد ما بنهاية الأركان خالص. قصف جديد يا شباب قصف خذونا بسرعة 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 بسرعة.
The Israeli Defense Minister shared video of the attack, saying, quote, "The painful blows have begun." Well, earlier today, Israel said it has struck the entrance to the headquarters of the Syrian armed forces in the capital.
Indeed, we have heard from the Israeli Defense Minister, Israel Katz, who said that Israel will intensify its attacks on government forces if they do not withdraw from Suweida. And indeed, in addition to the strikes that we've seen in the Syrian capital of Damascus, there have also been Israeli strikes in and near Suweida, including strikes on tanks and other heavy equipment.
Syrian government forces deployed there have been clashing with fighters from the Druze religious minority after a ceasefire collapsed. Israel has been launching strikes in the area for 2 days now, saying it aims to protect the Druze minority and to keep the area close to its own border demilitarized.
There appears to be a reluctance to just straight out invade for now. And this attack, you know, it's kind of called a knock on the ceiling type attack. Of the entryway to the major, to the Syrian military command headquarters in Damascus is seen as a warning shot. But what it is warning of is unclear.
The reason of this intervention from Israel is the same as the first interventions by Israel, meaning it's responding to the Druze community in Israel asking Netanyahu to act, meaning the religious head of the Druze community in Israel is Sheikh Atrifi. He's very close with Sheikh Al-Hijri that we mentioned, one of the prominent religious Druze leader in Syria, and he is pushing him to push Netanyahu in order to intervene. We saw demonstrations in the streets of Israel by the Druze community asking him to intervene on behalf of the Druze community in Syria. So the situation is very bizarre, actually, because the Druze community in Syria was very pro-Assad before the fall of Assad, meaning against Israel. Yeah. So we are seeing the cards being reshuffled.
Pretty sure that Israel took out a building as a live newscast was going on when they bombed Tehran. This time around, it's in Damascus, Syria. This is the world today. And also, this is what happens when Judah, little Judah, is roused from sleep. The Bible says that they have their hands at the neck of their enemies. This is quite a lot of action. Following the dreadful, tragic day, October 7, 2023. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily. We appreciate you joining us on today's show. You can get to the live video stream of this program at TrumpetDaily.com or at the Rumble channel. Just go to Rumble.com/TrumpetDaily. At Rumble, give us the thumbs up, please, and also leave a nice comment. And if you want to send in some feedback, too, our email, the Trumpet... I had a total brain freeze. TheTrumpet.com. Go to the website instead. Tomorrow I'll give you the email address. It shows I haven't used that in a while, so I'll have to get back into that. But we do get some email from time to time, and I've had a lot actually stack up just in recent weeks. Hopefully today or tomorrow I can get through some of that. Today's the 16th, by the way, July the 16th. I think it's the 36th anniversary of essentially the start of the Philadelphia Church of God. This work didn't officially start until January of 1990, but on this day, 36 years ago, I was the first one to read Malachi's message, my father's manuscript at that time, and of course the work sprung from that publication, that little book, Malachi's Message to God's Church Today. We really have put some years behind us. Lots of, as I was telling the campers and the workers this morning, I mean, we really are part of something truly glorious to be a part of God's work, to be defenders of the faith, to be able to defend the truth of God. I told the campers about the 6 years of litigation from 1997 to 2003. I mean, this predates our teens, but this is their history. I mean, that was like, see, in the spiritual sense, fighting for Mystery of the Ages, fighting for Mr. Armstrong's works, his written works. Spiritually speaking, that was like Operation Rising Lion, because we would not be deterred. We were on a mission, defenders of the truth, at a time when everyone else cast the truth to the ground, buried the truth. Israel was asleep at the wheel in the lead up to October 7. But what we've seen since is a rising lion. And of course, as if right on cue, you've got the United States twisting the arm of Israel, saying, now back off, back, never mind the Druze that are being persecuted in southern Syria. Someone tweeted out, not only is Israel not committing genocide in Gaza, we know about Gaza, right? It's preventing one in Syria. You don't get that on MSNBC or CNN. Preventing a genocide? It says, just ask the Syrian Defense Ministry, getting bombed here. Long after all the genocide liars are dead and forgotten, Israel's protection of fellow minorities in the Middle East will be remembered. That's that's a truth bomb right there. All of these deranged, delusional commentators saying that Israel's carrying out genocide, they're trying to prevent one in Syria. Then you can almost hear the Trump administration now. Well, now hang on. We've got a new leader. I know it used to be Al-Qaeda, but we've got a new leader in Syria, and we want to work with them. And we want to please our other friends in Qatar and UAE and Saudi Arabia. Listen to Bibi Netanyahu. This is him. It's in Hebrew, but it's got the subtitles. He's pleading with the Israeli Druze not to cross the border into Syria to basically go help out their brothers. I mean, Israel's concerned there's another October 7 style attack that could play out in southern Syria because of all the hatred and the animosity that exists between these tribal peoples. This is the world we live in. I mean, you turn it on from one day to the next, there's one explosion after another, sometimes literally. Let me read to you first what Matthew 24 says. I went through part of the Olivet prophecy the other day, and maybe we'll have more time for it on today's show. We also have the rest of Melanie Phillips' interview. We'll try to squeeze that in at the end of the show. But in Matthew 24 and verse 6, it says, "And you shall hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you be not troubled, for all these things must come to pass." I mean, this must happen. This is what happens in the lead up to Jesus Christ. This is what all of the peacemakers do not understand or grasp. They are not looking to God. They are not looking to the prophecies of God. They're not looking to God and His truth for the solutions. They're just trying to figure it out as they go. And a lot of the ideas have just been recycled century after century after century. Although it's particularly bad now, given, as I said yesterday, the spread of German rationalism into the educational bloodstream here in the West, here in the United States. And you've got all of these fantasists coming out of the universities that say, if you can just sit down and talk this through, you can make peace. in Syria, in Iran. And meanwhile, there's just more war, war and rumors of war. It says in verse 7, for nation shall rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom, and there shall be famines and pestilences and earthquakes in diverse places. He says all this is the beginning, just the beginning of sorrows. We're seeing the beginning of that now. Here was Bibi earlier today, as I say, pleading with the Druze not to leave into Syria. It's too dangerous, he says. Clip 3.
אחי אזרחי ישראל הדרוזים, המצב בסוודה, המצב בדרום מערב סוריה, הוא חמור מאוד. צהל פועל, חיל האוויר פועל, כוחות אחרים פועלים. אנחנו פועלים כדי להציל את אחינו הדרוזים וכדי לחסל את כנופיות המשטר. ועכשיו יש לי בקשה אחת מכם. אתם, אזרחי ישראל, אל תעברו את הגבול. אתם מסכנים את חייכם, אתם יכולים להירצח, אתם יכולים להיחטף, ואתם פוגעים במאמצים של צה"ל. ולכן אני מבקש מכם, חזרו לבתיכם, תנו לצה"ל לפעול.
It's pretty bold, really. And that latest issue of the Trumpet magazine, this is Israel's rising lion. There's not too many world leaders left that show such courage and boldness. Look, don't leave to Syria and help your brothers up there. It's too dangerous. And plus, you know, you might get in the way of the IDF. We'll take care of this. The IDF has swung into action. And you see buildings in Damascus going up in flames. This from the Times of Israel, as I say, perfect timing. It's what you would expect, given what's happened in the last 6 months. U.S. said to press for halt to Syria strikes. We told the Israelis to stop and take a breath. Did you tell the Syrians to stop killing Druze? I mean, what is wrong with our diplomats? This could possibly drive a wedge. We know they were all smiling last week, the Israeli representatives together with their U.S. counterparts. But here's yet another bone of contention. You know, there's already plenty of people in Washington that see Bibi Netanyahu as a warmonger. Trump comes to the aid of Israel with that operation in the middle of the night in Iran. And then they're in intense discussions all last week to try to bring a ceasefire to Gaza. Well, now it's firing up in Syria. It seems like America is so eager to work with these terrorist-sponsoring nations. Axios gives a pretty good timeline. I think I can bounce through some of this quickly. It says that Trump, the administration, asked Israel to calm down, dial it back. It says the U.S. officials are highly concerned that the Israeli attacks, including on Syrian military headquarters in Damascus and near the presidential palace, could destabilize the new Syrian government, as if it's stable in and of itself. Lots of instability all across the region. It says here, the official said the past 48 hours could seriously undermine progress toward a new security agreement between Israel and Syria. Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State, he said that the U.S. was very concerned about the Israeli strikes in Syria. You always see the statements like this, you know, very concerned about Israel, what Israel's doing. What about the terrorists and what they're doing? I mean, yeah, we've all got to look at ourselves. We've got to see the evil within as well as the evil without. But what's happening? I mean, it's prophesied to unravel this brotherhood. They're prophesied to fight with one another. It used to be that we were all together, allied with one another. There's still moments of that, like with the 12-day war, but still. Israeli officials claim the tanks, there were tanks moving into southern Syria, okay, close to Israel. It says Israeli officials claim the tanks entered a zone that Israel, which is occupying parts of western Syria, has demanded to be demilitarized of heavy weapons. So Israel's made this demand going back a few months ago. And as far as Bibi Netanyahu is concerned, I mean, this is justification enough for a strike like what you saw there on live television in Syria. It says here, the leaders of the Druze community in Israel pressed the Israeli government to intervene, claiming militias affiliated with the Syrian government were carrying out a massacre of Druze in Sawida. Okay, so there's no official statements that I know of coming from the State Department saying to the Arabs in southern Syria, connected to the Syrian government, carrying out a massacre in Sawida, no strongly worded statements for them. Hey, let's have a ceasefire. they carry out these atrocities, and everyone's a victim, men, women, children, babies. You know how it played out on October 7. We watched a short video today in the SEP forum, just kind of summarizing the events of the Holocaust. Same thing. I mean, the Nazis just took babies into the gas chambers. It didn't matter. Women, children. The objective is to kill Jews. And in the 1940s, Hitler was pretty good at it. In fact, after having firing squads kill so many of them, tens of thousands, they realized, well, that's too slow. We've got to have gas chambers. We've got to burn them alive in ovens. That's 80-some years ago. That's not that long ago in the grand scheme of things. As I told the campers, I know you're teenagers and you don't remember the lawsuit over God's truth, mystery of the ages. But there's plenty of people still alive. As I said yesterday, they're dying off. But, you know, there's people that remember World War II and that remember the Holocaust. And as I've said recently, I mean, in some ways, October 7 takes it to another level, because with the Nazis, they tried to cover up their crimes. Hamas tried to broadcast it. They're proud of their efforts to exterminate Jews. And then when the Jews respond, why are they always told to, hey, pull back. Let's calm down. Let's not escalate things. It says here, on Tuesday night, local time, and into Wednesday morning, Israel escalated its strikes against Syria. This is Axios, remember. And other Syrian targets. On Wednesday around noon local time, this would be today, hundreds of Israeli Druze broke through the border fence with Syria in the Golan Heights and entered the buffer zone between the countries in an attempt to reach Sueda. They're running to help their fellow Druze. I mean, they're showing some courage. They're breaking through Israel's security fence, only in the other direction. They're not getting into Israel trying to kill Jews. They're trying to defend their brothers. And Israel, for its part, the government, the IDF, Benjamin Netanyahu is saying, look, don't get in the way. We'll take care of this. Israel intervening to stop a massacre, to stop another genocide. Let's just get rid of the Druze. We don't like them. What a world. Wars and rumors of wars. Israeli officials claim the strikes are intended to protect the Druze minority in Syria as part of its commitment to the Druze community in Israel, and that Syrian militias affiliated with the government have been killing dozens of Druze. Killing dozens of Druze? Really? And they're just getting away with it? And there's no strongly worded statements from the U.S. or the U.N. or anybody? I guess not. That's the position that Israel finds itself in repeatedly. Repeatedly. It says here, the U.S. official said the Israeli government told the Trump administration it sees what happened in Sawida as an October 7-like attack on the Druze community. So Israel learned its lesson 20 months ago, and they don't want to see it happen again. The latest issue of The Trumpet, I don't think I have it up here, but it's got Bibi Netanyahu on the cover, and it says, Rising Lion, Israel's Rising Lion. My father writes how that he was stirred by Netanyahu's action, his bold, aggressive leadership. And then he ties in a spiritual lesson. He says, what Israel did to neutralize Iran teaches all mankind powerful lessons about what it takes to overcome evil. And it's a specific reminder to those God has called to back his watchman work in this dangerous end time. To achieve what God wants us to, we all need the spirit of a rising lion. We need to spring to action. We need a lion-like spirit. And we're seeing in the physical sense, we're seeing a pretty good example of it. It's unusual these days. It's rare. Isaiah 3 says that strong leadership is being taken away. You just don't see strength and boldness and courage like you used to. Instead, you see a lot of compromise and surrender and dialogue and negotiation. Read through Isaiah 33 sometime. Well, maybe I can take you through a few verses. I don't have it in my notes, so I'll have to do it the old-fashioned way. Isaiah 33, verse 3, to begin with. It describes what's coming on this world. I mean, it's in some ways, it's like an Olivet prophecy. Verse 3, it says, and the noise of the tumult, at the noise of the tumult, the people fled. At the lifting up of yourself, the nations were scattered. This is in the lead up to the Great Tribulation, which then culminates in the return of Jesus Christ to this earth. Notice verse 9. It says, the earth mourns and languishes. Lebanon is ashamed and hewn down. Sharon is like a wilderness, and Bashan and Carmel shake off their fruits. I mean, there's a lot of mourning and sadness. You back up to verse 7, though. And it says, behold, their valiant ones shall cry without, and ambassadors, the ambassadors of peace, shall weep bitterly. The ambassadors for peace, the diplomats, the negotiators, when everything explodes, just like that building did on live television, when it explodes in our faces, there's going to be a lot of weeping and mourning when mankind finally awakens to the fact that we haven't been able to solve our problems. Jesus said in the Olivet prophecy, Matthew 24, 21 and 22, that great tribulation is coming. And we need to be counted worthy to escape. That's in Luke 21. But here, Isaiah 33, where is it? Verse 18, it says, your heart shall meditate terror. I mean, we have to be a realist, not a fantasist. We have to be real. We have to look at this world as it is. This is not God's world. This is not a safe place. You're just seeing one more explosion after another. It's becoming almost routine. Now, don't get calloused, God says, but meditate on the terror. Meditate on these atrocities and make sure that you're ready and prepared, even emotionally. Obviously, spiritually, most of all, but even emotionally, get ready for what is coming. So much suffering. Why does there have to be so much suffering? Well, God's trying to get our attention. God's trying to get us to turn to Him in humility and repentance and faith, to look to Him, to bring Him into our lives, and along with it, blessings from God and safety. And deliverance, protection, all those things too. I mean, we need God in this dying world. We need God in this dangerous world. We need God looking after us and looking after our children. Meditate on the terror. Meditate on what's coming. Make sure you're prepared and ready. Back to this article, Israel's Rising Lion. My father says, Netanyahu has fought and won like no Israeli prime minister for quite some time. He has the will to fight, 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 fight for his nation. He has the will. For so many of the Israelite nations, their will's broken. There's only a very few exceptions left. That being strong leadership, with a will to fight, with a will to face down your enemies that want to kill you or kill your friends. In the case of the Druze, these are Israeli Druze. I mean, look at how diverse, just as an aside, how diverse the Israeli population is. It exposes the lie that is Israel's committing genocide. No, I think it's Israel's enemies that are out there trying to eliminate or exterminate all the Jews. It's obvious. It's in their charters, as I've said. It's in their religious texts, as Melanie Phillips has said. There's not too many people that go there. I mean, even after 9/11, George W. Bush bent over backwards, basically, to say Islam is a religion of peace. Like, we're not, we're just, the war is against terrorism. And what does that mean? Is it against Iran? Oh, certainly not. Iraq, well, you know, we do have an occupation in Iraq for a short time, but we're just going after the terrorists. That's not the way great warriors of the past used to talk. They spoke with boldness. They spoke about crushing the enemy. But you can't talk that way these days, because then you're going to be you're going to be attacked. The will is broken, my father says. Well, he uses the example of Churchill and the courage that he had. Of course, Bibi Netanyahu is a big fan of Winston Churchill. He's read just about every book on him. And Churchill demonstrated some courageous leadership as well, even when he was ridiculed and mocked. Even when he was alone in the wilderness, he stood alone and he kept sounding the alarm. He kept delivering God's warning, that rising lion operation. That title comes from Numbers 23. You can read about it in the book of Numbers. As I say, Bibi Netanyahu's also rare. He's also rare as far as leadership goes, in the sense that he does cite and chapter and verse from time to time. That's unusual. In a world where the Bible is just dismissed and ridiculed and buried, we ought to dig it up and dig into it and see what God has to say. And look at all of these prophecies describing our time today, like Matthew 24, like Isaiah 33, as we just read. This is our instruction manual, our guidebook for living. And it's also loaded with prophecy. And it tells us what's coming next. Tomorrow's news today. When we come back, we'll finish today's show with the rest of our sit-down with Melanie Phillips in Jerusalem just last week. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily. We'll be right back.
Daily News, Bible prophecy. See the connection on The Trumpet Daily. Are you feeling overwhelmed by the flood of news and information? You need something to sift the news and bring you only what matters most. You need The Trumpet Daily. You also need something to help you understand not just what's happening now, but what will happen next. You need The Trumpet Daily. Only The Trumpet Daily accurately matches daily news to precise Bible prophecies. Because Bible prophecy is the only tool up to the task of sifting the news down to what's important and showing you what will happen next. Join host Stephen Fleury every weekday. Go to trumpetdaily.com.
Not yeah. a word.
You said about Keir Starmer. I think you wrote this earlier. Starmer's defining characteristic is lack of leadership. It's not just the British Prime Minister's lackluster manner, his pedantry, his absence of inspiring rhetoric. It's that he so often says one thing that's promptly undermined by the next thing, that he ducks saying what he actually believes. And even when he does vouchsafe this, fails to follow through by leading from the front. So how do you end up with such weak leaders in these Western nations? You mentioned that there's still, you know, millions and millions of people that see it, they understand it, they get it. But it just seems like leaders like this somehow get there time and time again.
Well, how did the American people end up having to choose between Kamala Harris and Donald Trump? Donald Trump, even if one thinks he's wonderful, he was an outlier. He didn't come from the establishment.
Right.
He was elected twice in revolt against an establishment which had lost the plot. The Democratic Party has completely lost the plot, just like the Labour Party in Britain and the progressive left, I think, across the West. So you have the same phenomenon that you have, you know, millions of ordinary people for whom the political establishment, both Republican and Democrat, conventionally understood, and Labour and Conservative in Britain, but the whole establishment, no longer stand up for what people understand to be their defining purpose, which is to protect their society and their culture and their nation. I mean, how do we get to that point? And, you know, when it comes to Britain, the Conservative Party, and this is another long story, but the Conservative Party lost, in my view, lost sight of what conservatism is a long time ago. And as a result, presided through one prime minister after another over accelerating disintegration of Britain as a properly functioning civic society, as well as destroying its defences. And consequently, you know, when the place was literally running in sewage, you know, the rivers were just sewers, and it was in practical terms that was true, and also in metaphorical terms, people said, this party cannot govern ever again. And consequently, Sir Keir Starmer's Labour Party, which was not popular, he was not a popular leader, people didn't trust him, they didn't like him, but he was elected because we couldn't elect the Conservatives, is what people thought. So you have overall a situation which kind of reflects the loss of mojo of the culture, of the society, of the nation itself. It's reflected in the politics.
Yeah.
You know, in America, it seems to me, forgive me for being presumptuous in saying so, but you've got a very divided society.
Oh, sure.
Between the Democrats and the liberal progressives on one side, and the Trumpists, and then the not-so-Trumpist Republicans on the other, but you've got a division.
Right.
In Britain, you don't really have a division. You have a kind of slide. Everyone's on the slide. People are on different gradations of the slide, but it's going down like that. There is no opposition. There's no division. So Britain and America are taking different forms, but basically it's a culture that is going down. Now, it's possible that it will recover. It's possible that President Trump will haul it back. Possibly. I don't know. Maybe he will, maybe he won't. Maybe he'll do what he can in the 4 years he has, but then it'll go backwards again. I've no idea.
Right.
None of us has any idea. But certainly at the moment, you know, you have a West which is in trouble.
Right.
And all the things that we're talking about, I think, are manifestations of that. Yeah. It's existential difficulty.
Who do you see as the last great leader of Britain? How long ago would you have to go, and who would it be? We've talked before about your political views and how you kind of went through the transformation. And you mentioned before we started the interview that at the time you met Margaret Thatcher, you didn't like her, you opposed her. Since you've kind of gone through this transformation, do you now see her a lot differently?
I see her differently, certainly. She had elements of greatness in her because she understood that Britain was on a trajectory of demoralization and decline, and she wanted to arrest it. She had a vision of Britain becoming great again. And that was a great thing. Mm-hmm. And she did some good things, some very good things. However, I am not a signed up member of the Margaret Thatcher fan club at all. I think she encapsulated much of what's gone wrong with conservatism, where it became confused with economic liberalism, which basically, to cut a very long story short again, it basically lined up so-called conservatives on the same territory as the left, which is the individual. And that's the road to ruin, because we stop looking after each other. And so where would you, what was the last great leader? Well, you know, Churchill was a great leader. He saved the West. He didn't just save Britain, he saved the West. So, you know, he was unequivocally a great leader. Without Churchill, there wouldn't be Britain. You know, it wouldn't be a free society. So that's, I think, unequivocal.
Your prime minister here, Netanyahu, he's a pretty big fan of Churchill. He's read, I think, just about every book about Churchill.
Yeah.
Do you think that motivates his leadership over Israel?
I'm not an unabridged fan of Netanyahu either. I don't think journalists should be fans of anybody, frankly. I think we should always, as journalists, stand back and say they do good things, they do bad things. Netanyahu is a great patriot. He is a great Jewish patriot. He understands Jewish history. He understands the arc of Jewish history. And he is totally and passionately and irrevocably and with his entire soul devoted to the survival of Israel and the Jewish people.
Right.
And that is his strength. And in that, his heart beats absolutely with Israel, with the people of Israel. And that's why he's still in power. Also, he has a strategic, a genius for a strategic thinking. He understands the big picture in a way that I can't think of anybody else who does understand that. However, I think he has certain flaws which I think get in the way of the leader he should be. It's another big topic.
He's had recently he's had meetings with President Trump, and you know, they've had big smiles, and President Trump's been out there to greet the motorcade as it drives up to the White House, and they've been talking about ending the war in Gaza and bringing the hostages back, and a lot of things actually. Do you feel like he's had 4 years separate his first term and then his second term obviously just started in January? Do you see President Trump's relationship with Israel or his views regarding Israel different than you did during President Trump's first term?
Well,
like during the first term, he's moving the embassy to Jerusalem.
Yeah, exactly.
They recognize the Golan Heights as Israeli territory. And it just seems like this time around, and again, it's too soon to tell. He did help with the Iran strike.
For sure,
But
for sure.
There's also quite a few commentators in the States that feel like he's applying a lot of pressure on Netanyahu to end these wars quickly and to negotiate with people that, as you say, want to kill Jews. And so, yeah, it seems like it's more of a mixed bag this time around from my perspective. How do you see it?
Well, it's all of those things. His first term, you know, he turned out to be the most consequential American president from the point of view of shifting things along for the better in this region that anybody could remember. And this term, so far, he is still being thought of in the same way because of what he's done in terms of supporting Israel in its war, and coming in, bringing America in the way that he did. But there is great unease. I mean, I'm very, very uneasy because of these things we've been talking about, which is his passion for the deal. And also his passion, it would seem, to have it all done and dusted. You know, I am the president, he said it over and over again. I am the president who's going to bring peace. I'm not going to make war. Okay, Well, you know, okay, we all understand that. We all want you to make peace, but there has to be, you know, it mustn't be the peace of the grave. And, you know, the idea you can stop war when, in fact, you could, you know, the idea you can just sort of, you know, threaten and do stuff and then you'll bring people on side and then it'll be ended is very nice, but it's not realistic when you're dealing with the Republic of Iran, for example. So I'm still concerned about this. I think he still wants to end it all. Right. He wants to have, you know, on his record. He doesn't want to be the president who, for most of his second term, presided over war. Well, he may not be able to avoid that, actually.
Yeah.
On the other hand, as I said before, you know, he could actually short circuit much of the Gaza stuff by taking the action against Qatar that he should be taking, which he's not taking. So I'm concerned about all those things. So life is complicated. President Trump is a complicated man. Prime Minister Netanyahu is a complicated man. Why does the world insist on seeing them as simple people? Either you are for them or you're against them. The idea that you can think that they do good things and bad things, no. They're either gotta be perfect or completely dreadful. What is this? This is a cartoon caricature of human nature. Life's not like that. So I take it bit by bit. I look at what's being done. I look at what's being said. I try and form a conclusion from what's being said and what's being done. In these circumstances, we haven't got the faintest idea what is being said or done, frankly, because we're in a war and people with different agendas are pouring in the whole time. We don't know to what extent we, the public, are being played. So we try to make sense of it as much as we can, bit by bit. That's as much as I can do. I don't try and form an overall view from the point of view of, you know, is this person good or bad? It's not like that.
Do you think Prime Minister Netanyahu will, to some extent, go along with this push to make deals?
I have no idea.
Do you feel like he's under intense pressure from President Trump?
Well, I'm pretty sure I can be confident in saying he's not under the kind of pressure he was under the administrations of President Biden or President Obama,
right,
who were basically, these were hostile administrations to Israel.
Right.
And I think Netanyahu did very well in keeping the show on the road as much as he could. But there's no doubt these two men did us in Israel and the Jewish people terrible, terrible harm. And a lot of blood is on their hands. A lot of Israeli blood is on their hands. In comparison, it's a breeze. But was there pressure? Of course there's pressure. You know, as soon as Trump came in, President Trump came in, virtually his first act, was it the next day, Mr. Witkoff was dispatched to this country, to Israel, and said to Prime Minister Netanyahu, cease fire. It was a disaster. It was a disaster. Cease fire and let the aid in. The aid came in. It helped Hamas. It helped them regroup and restock, and the ceasefire helped them regroup and restock. As a result, Israelis have died. Huh? I mean, how is one to evaluate this? That's what Trump did on his first day. Later on, he sent his bombers in to demolish Fordo. I mean, you know, one has to look at these things as they come and evaluate them as they come and, you know, avoid these facile, overarching conclusions which bear no relation to reality at all.
Yeah. Just a couple more points before we conclude. As far as negotiations are concerned, the Bring Them Home Now campaign, I'm not Israeli, but it seems like that movement is getting stronger, where it's give up whatever in order to get the hostages back. And I guess there's still 50 or so that are in captivity. So where do you stand on, I mean, everybody obviously wants the hostages returned.
Of course.
You mentioned the Qatar example, that's the best way to apply the pressure to get it done. If that's not happening, where are you with respect to the push to give up you know, in the case of some of these lopsided swaps, all these terrorists in exchange for, you know, 5 or 10 Israeli
hostages. This is an impossible dilemma. It's an impossible dilemma because while Hamas hold the hostages, they have the cards in their hand.
I think you said in our last interview that it was sort of their ticket to survival.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right. I don't know. I mean, you know, I'm listening to a lot of voices, military voices. Some say, and there's an argument that's going on here the whole time about this, within the IDF, within the Israeli Defense Forces, between the IDF and the government, within the government, within the public. I do think that, you know, the hostage issue has been unforgivably weaponized here in Israel by the left. The left has one objective only: to bring down Netanyahu. Whether or not you support Netanyahu is not the issue. You may think he's dreadful. To use the hostages, use their relatives, and what those relatives have been going through is unthinkable. To use that terrible distress, these vulnerable people, in order to weaponize the fate of the hostages against Netanyahu and to blame him, therefore, for not bringing them home, and to say there's blood on his hands because he's not brought them home. The cost of bringing, the price of bringing them home is Israel's surrender. That's been made absolutely clear by Hamas from the start. You want the hostages back? Fine. You surrender. We remain in power. We remain here. You guarantee not to come after us. You guarantee to stop the war. You guarantee everything for us. And then they come home. In other words, total surrender. So what Netanyahu is being asked to do is to sacrifice the lives and security of 10 million people for what was originally 240. Okay? Now that is unforgivable, to have a mass movement on the streets and threatening, intimidating, not just Netanyahu, but his emissary, Ron Dermer, outside Ron Dermer's house. These demonstrations the whole time. You're killing the hostages. What is this? It's disgusting. So I feel very strongly about that, as you can probably hear. In terms of the issue itself, I don't know how I would resolve it. It's the most terrible dilemma. I'm hearing military people say, we can do it. We need to starve them. We need to starve the Hamas out. And we're not being allowed to do that because America, even now, is, and the world is saying, you must bring in aid. And we can now see, actually, again, we're trying to see through the fog of war, but what is clearly happening now is that there is a kind of new front that's emerged ever since the American, Gaza Humanitarian Foundation got going. The Hamas is throwing everything at this because they have to prevent aid, food from getting to the Gazans. It must come to them, otherwise they're finished. So now we're seeing a very complicated situation and more games being played. I use the word games advisedly, in which the Hamas are claiming that the IDF are shooting Gazans dead in the food queues deliberately, and this is being peddled by people like American news media outlets and in Britain. Whereas, in fact, it's the Hamas who are killing Gazans for queuing up for food. And insofar as the IDF have killed people in those queues, it is clearly because they have been unable to cope with the fact that they are being rushed by possible Hamas people trying to kill them. And it's almost impossible to tell who is Hamas and who is not. Hamas don't wear uniforms. How do they know? It's the fog of war, the confusion of war, being projected through this malevolent prism, which is the prism through which the Western media, by and large, present Israel. So it's a very complicated situation. You know, how the fate of the hostages can be resolved in this is not clear to me. I'm not a military person. I hear people saying, you know, if we starve, if we can isolate the Gazan civilians from the Hamas. So we'll feed the Gazan civilians, but then we will starve out the Hamas. I mean, can you imagine the Western reaction to starve, the word starving anybody? They're not going to allow it. So it's so complicated. I don't know whether that would work. I've no idea. But I wouldn't like to be in Netanyahu's position.
Yeah, well, speaking of that one, you mentioned Hamas's demand is for Israel to surrender. Bibi's talked about Hamas surrendering or just totally crushing Hamas government. Well, how does that happen, given all of the complications you just said?
Again, I can't answer your question because I'm not a military expert in any shape or form. But I'm hearing that it is, in the view of military experts that I'm listening to, entirely possible and doable, and could have been done a long time ago, had the West not insisted on basically helping Hamas survive. It can be done. Okay, so people say you can't kill the ideology. Well, of course you can't kill the ideology. We're talking about the Muslim Brotherhood. You're not going to kill the ideology of Islamism, political Islam. Of course not. But I am persuaded that you can destroy Hamas as a functioning military force and threat. I'm persuaded about that. How you keep that situation in Gaza from descending again is, I'm sure, being discussed at this very moment in America. That's why, you know, President Trump said, you know, encourage them to move out and move in people who will properly look after the place. I don't know whether that's possible, but the idea that you can destroy Hamas as a military force that can threaten Israel, of course that can be done.
Yeah. One last thing. You mentioned the meetings between President Trump and Bibi Netanyahu. What's your initial take on that, whether it's been helpful, successful, or harmful?
I have no idea, and nobody has any idea. Yeah. Nobody knows what these two men have said to each other. All we know is the spin and the agendas that are coming out from every possible source. I haven't got the faintest idea what's going on. I hope that eventually I will find out.
I will just say in conclusion that I love the clarity. Anytime I have a discussion with you, it just seems like how you see it, how you explain it, it's crystal clear.
Even when I'm very unclear, I'm clear that I'm unclear.
Even when you're very tired, as you said before we started, you did a great job. So many things to mention. You write columns for the Times of London. I mentioned your book, The Builder's Stone, last time you were on the show. You're on X, and then you've got melaniephillips.substack.com.
That's where you can find all my work, yeah.
All right. Well, thanks again for being so generous with your time. Melanie Phillips.
Always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you so much.